Imagine walking into a retail store, picking up a sealed video game off the shelf, paying full price, and tearing off the plastic wrap in the parking lot, only to find absolutely nothing inside the box. It's just a single piece of cardboard.
Right, just an empty box.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that isn't some theoretical retail scam. Mm. According to the stack of sources we're looking at today, that is the new blueprint for a multi-billion dollar gaming empire. I mean, we are looking at an industry that has fundamentally rearranged itself overnight.
It really is a radical pivot. We're examining this inflection point where multiple massive industry dominoes have fallen simultaneously, and it's completely redefining the boundaries between the consumer and the corporation.
Okay, let's unpack this, because that is exactly the mission for today's deep dive.
Yeah.
We're sifting through excerpts from a really comprehensive report titled Tekken Knight, The Great Tech and Gaming Shift.
Yeah, and the material covers what seems like a pretty chaotic wave of news.
Oh, totally. We've got Nintendo's worst-kept secret leaking out, Xbox going through a profound identity crisis, unprecedented government interventions in AI, critical network vulnerabilities at the enterprise level, and even a hardware startup building a revolutionary rocket engine.
Right, and while it might look like a fragmented news cycle at first glance, there is this deeply cohesive narrative running through all these sources.
Which is what makes it so fascinating.
Exactly. We're basically witnessing the solidification of a new tech era defined by the illusion of control. Across every sector, there's this massive centralization of corporate and state power, and it's aggressively forcing you, the consumer, to make hard choices about digital autonomy, security, and, well, physical ownership.
So true. And we have to start with the epicenter of this ownership crisis, which is the gaming industry. The domino that initiated this recent cascade is Nintendo, or more accurately, Ubisoft accidentally leaking Nintendo's highly guarded hardware plans.
Yeah, that was a huge slip-up. Ubisoft mistakenly listed an upcoming title, The Crew Motorfest, for the unannounced Nintendo Switch 2.
Which was basically confirmation the console exists.
Right. But more importantly, it revealed Nintendo's brand new distribution method. It's designated in the supply chain as the GameKey card.
And this is wild because the original Switch was practically built on the nostalgia of physical media.
Yeah.
You bought a game, you got a physical proprietary flash cartridge, popped it in, and you played.
Yeah, it was super straightforward.
But the GameKey card is this jarring departure. Based on the report, it is essentially like buying an empty DVD case at a store, opening it up, and just finding an IOU inside.
That is a great way to put it.
Right. You're purchasing a physical package at retail, but there's zero game media inside. Just a cardboard insert with a localized download code to pull the digital version from Nintendo's servers.
What's fascinating here is the underlying economic and logistical mechanism driving this change. Nintendo is basically attempting to walk this highly complex tightrope between keeping a retail presence and getting those massive digital margins.
Because the supply chain benefits for them have to be staggering.
Oh, absolutely. By abandoning those proprietary flash cartridges, they completely eliminate immense semiconductor manufacturing costs.
Wow, yeah, that makes sense.
Plus, the shipping weight of their global inventory just drops exponentially. That slashes freight costs and gives them this environmentally friendly PR angle, you know, regarding reduced plastic and e-waste.
But they still get the shelf space.
Exactly. They still dominate physical shelf space at major retailers with bright, colorful boxes, which is still a massive driver for impulse purchases and holiday shopping.
But the trade-off for the player is just a complete loss of leverage. I mean, by purchasing an empty box, you are now entirely dependent on a localized internet connection just to access a single-player offline game.
Right, and the secondary market is instantly vaporized.
Poof, gone. You can't trade a used GameKey card to a friend or sell it back to a store. You are entirely beholden to the lifespan of the publisher's servers. If Nintendo decides to shutter the Switch 2 digital storefront in 15 years, that piece of cardboard becomes literal trash.
And the leak also gave us a vital piece of industry intelligence regarding timelines.
Oh, right, the launch window.
Yeah, with major third-party publishers like Ubisoft already integrating this GameKey card format into their forward-looking retail supply chains, logistics analysts in the report are pointing to an early 2027 launch window for the Switch 2.
Which means we have to get a formal announcement late in 2026.
Exactly. Now, Nintendo's attempt to find a middle ground by keeping the empty box on the shelf contrasts pretty sharply with Sony's current strategy.
Yeah, Sony has declared an all-out aggressive war on physical media. They are systematically stripping the optical disc drives entirely out of their newer PlayStation 5 hardware revisions.
And the sources detail a really fierce consumer backlash to this. Gamers are actively organizing online protests and canceling their PlayStation Plus subscription services en masse to, hit Sony's recurring revenue.
But the data in the report reveals an uncomfortable reality for those protesting gamers, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. The protest is basically a mathematical dead end. Sony isn't stripping the disc drives out of malice. They are simply responding to an overwhelming shift in market thermodynamics.
Give us the numbers on that.
Well, industry analysts project that by 2025, 78% of all game sales will be purely digital.
That leaves physical media with barely a quarter of the market share. That's crazy.
It's actually worse when you look at the raw revenue disparity. Physical game revenue is projected to plummet to $19 billion globally, while digital revenue is skyrocketing to $67 billion.
Wow, $19 billion versus $67 billion.
Right. And the demographic data is really the final fatal blow to physical media. 89% of gamers under the age of 25 only purchase digital games.
Wait, 89%? So the physical market is literally aging out of existence.
Exactly. But dismissing the protest as just consumers clinging to the convenience of a physical disc really misses the psychological core of the issue.
Yeah, the friction isn't about the plastic. It's about the legal definition of ownership. Because when you purchase a digital PS5 game, you aren't buying a product. You are purchasing a revocable license.
You are permanently trading ownership for access. If a publisher loses a music licensing agreement in a game, or if Sony's authentication servers experience an outage, your entire digital library can just evaporate instantly.
So the anxiety driving the protests is totally valid?
It is. However, Sony holds an asymmetrical advantage here. When a highly anticipated title launches, the overwhelming majority of those protesting consumers will quietly resubscribe because Sony controls the exclusive gateway to the software.
Which perfectly transitions us to the third pillar of this console space, Xbox. If Sony and Nintendo are fundamentally dictating how we purchase software, Microsoft is frantically trying to dictate where we are allowed to play it.
Yeah, Microsoft's hardware sales have cratered to historic lows.
All right, so to artificially inflate the value of the Xbox console, they are executing this violent 180-degree reversal in corporate strategy. They're retreating back to a closed, walled garden exclusivity model.
They're pulling massive impending titles like The Elder Scrolls 6, The Fable Reboot, and Perfect Dark, and insisting they will remain entirely exclusive to the Xbox ecosystem.
I have to push back on the viability of Microsoft's new pivot here, because the hypocrisy of this move is just staggering. Wait, Microsoft spent 3 years aggressively marketing a Play Anywhere ecosystem.
Right, the whole Game Pass Everywhere approach.
Exactly. They conditioned their entire user base to believe that traditional console exclusivity was a dinosaur, that cloud streaming and hardware agnosticism were the future, and now they're suddenly building a walled garden again.
I know, it feels like a profound breach of trust.
It really does. It feels like they are punishing the consumer for their own hardware failures.
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, Microsoft's erratic behavior is the direct result of fighting a brutal, multi-front economic war that they are currently losing.
Losing pretty badly, it seems.
Yeah. They are being simultaneously crushed by Sony's record-breaking PS5 market penetration, outmaneuvered in the portable sector by Nintendo's massive momentum, and undercut in the PC space by the rapid rise of devices like the Steam Deck.
So they're operating from a position of sheer desperation.
Exactly. But taking a step back, whether it is Microsoft hoarding exclusive IP to force hardware sales, Sony executing the disc drive, or Nintendo selling empty cardboard boxes, this entire gaming segment perfectly illustrates our core theme.
Which is the massive centralization of corporate power over the user experience, where the consumer is systematically stripped of their autonomy.
Precisely.
And that theme of surrendering control seamlessly bridges into our next source. Because the logic of relying on cloud-managed systems in gaming directly mirrors a much more dangerous reliance in the enterprise space.
Oh, absolutely. The stakes escalate dramatically here. While gamers are worried about losing access to their digital libraries, there is a silent critical loss of control happening at the foundational infrastructure layer of our networks.
Yeah, the report highlights an active crisis involving Ubiquiti, specifically surrounding their Unify operating system. They were forced to rush out emergency security patches for 7 critical vulnerabilities.
But one specific flaw is an absolute nightmare scenario. It received a perfect 10.0 score on the CVSS scale.
And for those unfamiliar with the terminology, CVSS stands for the Common Vulnerability Scoring System. It's the industry's standardized framework for rating the severity of software flaws based on how easily it can be exploited and its impacts.
Right. And a 10.0 out of 10 isn't just a glitch. It is the highest possible severity rating a vulnerability can achieve.
So it's as bad as it gets.
Yes. The specific classification of this 10.0 vulnerability is unauthenticated command injection.
Break down the mechanics of why that is so devastating.
Well, you have to look at how network hardware processes instructions. In a secure system, a user must prove who they are with a password or credentials before the router will execute any command.
Makes sense.
But this flaw allows a malicious actor to completely bypass that authentication layer. They can send a maliciously crafted data packet directly to the router's management interface, and the router mistakenly interprets that rogue packet as a legitimate root-level system command.
Wow. So the attacker can execute arbitrary code without a password, without prior access, and without even tricking a user into clicking a phishing link.
Exactly. They just bypass everything.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. So an unauthenticated command injection, it's basically like installing a state-of-the-art titanium vault door on your house, but leaving a giant invisible hole in the wall that anyone can walk through without a key.
That captures the dynamic perfectly. The attacker immediately gains control of the digital brain of the network. They control traffic routing, firewall policies, internal access.
Everything.
Everything. They can silently siphon sensitive data or use the compromised gateway as a launching pad to attack every connected laptop, server, and smart device within that environment.
But the danger isn't just the technical severity of the flaw, right? It's the specific demographic that relies on this hardware.
Right. That is the tragic irony of the situation. Ubiquiti Unify equipment is massively popular specifically because it's marketed as providing enterprise-grade security for organizations that lack enterprise-level budgets.
So we're talking about small to medium businesses, university departments, local hospitality venues, and even prosumers running it in their home.
Exactly. The very organizations that purchase this hardware to secure their perimeters are the ones sitting on a 10.0 vulnerability. And these are entities that do not have dedicated 247 IT security operations centers monitoring their network traffic.
So the organizations least equipped to handle a massive automated data breach are the exact targets exposed by this flaw.
Yes, which introduces a highly concerning variable into the equation.
Yeah, because if the fundamental physical networking hardware we rely on is this inherently vulnerable to bad actors, what happens when we introduce ultra-powerful AI into that fragile mix?
That intersection of vulnerable infrastructure and advanced AI is generating severe anxiety within national security circles right now. Our sources detail the recent release of OpenAI's GPT 5.6 model.
And the technical capabilities are a massive leap forward.
Oh, huge. The architecture of GPT 5.6 vastly outperforms previous iterations in complex logical reasoning and advanced mathematical problem solving.
And it utilizes that highly advanced chain of thought processing, allowing the model to break down incredibly dense problems step by step.
Exactly. With unprecedented accuracy, all while maintaining deep, coherent context over massive, extended interactions.
But the leap in processing power isn't the primary focus of the report. The real story here is the unprecedented intervention by the United States government. They actually stepped in and effectively grounded the release of GPT 5.6 for months.
This raises an important question about the modern role of the state in technological innovation. And it's critical to note, just to be absolutely clear, this delay was not driven by partisan politics.
Right. We're just looking at the security facts provided.
Yes. It was the result of concrete, highly specific threat assessments compiled by intelligence and cybersecurity officials regarding the model's unconstrained capabilities.
So keeping the focus strictly on those security facts, the government's threat model identified four specific vectors of catastrophic risk that forced them to halt the launch. What's the first one?
The first vector is advanced malware generation. Officials analyzed how an AI with vastly superior logic and coding capabilities could autonomously write incredibly sophisticated, novel cyber attacks.
Like finding that Ubiquiti 10.0 vulnerability we just talked about.
Exactly. A model like GPT 5.6 could theoretically identify a flaw like that, generate a custom exploit, and automate a deployment strategy across the internet before human analysts even realized the vulnerability existed.
That is terrifying. What's the second vector?
The second vector focuses on industrial-scale misinformation. The context window of GPT 5.6 allows it to generate highly convincing, deeply nuanced false narratives, complete with fabricated supporting evidence at a volume that human moderators simply cannot physically process.
Right, so it's not just spam, it's highly targeted, coherent campaigns.
Precisely. Now, the third vector outlined in the source is autonomous decision-making. Security officials expressed deep concern over the model's ability to act as an autonomous agent.
Meaning it could make high-speed, highly complex decisions regarding things like financial markets or network operations without direct, step-by-step human oversight.
Yes, which is incredibly risky. And the final vector is the concept of safety bypasses.
Oh, this one is wild.
Intelligence analysts fear that a model with this level of advanced reasoning might possess the capacity to analyze its own ethical constraints, recognize them as arbitrary limits, and actively compute novel methods to circumvent its own safety protocols.
Wow. So as a result, OpenAI was forced to implement incredibly strict, sophisticated new guardrails, effectively lobotomizing certain capabilities just to get authorization for a public launch.
And agree to ongoing opaque government monitoring. This marks a monumental paradigm shift. It is the definitive end of Silicon Valley's move fast and break things era in AI.
You can no longer deploy a powerful tool into the wild and promise to patch the societal consequences in the next software update. Stricter guardrails are now the mandatory cost of doing business.
Exactly. It's a whole new regulatory world.
So we are seeing this absolute gridlock of digital restrictions closing in from all sides. Mega corporations are dictating what media you can own, failing network protocols are leaving infrastructure exposed, and governments are hard-coding legal limits into what an AI is permitted to compute.
Right. It feels like control is being stripped away at every level.
But while the software and digital realms are facing these increasingly tighter leashes, the final segment of our report pivots to this incredible story about a hardware startup attempting to physically break out of that gridlock.
Yeah, we are looking at Venus Aerospace, a company attempting to solve a monumental problem in physical engineering.
They just closed a $91 million funding round to scale up the development of a rotating detonation rocket engine, or an RDRE.
Which is just a staggering piece of technology.
It really is. Now, the thermodynamics outlined in the report are incredibly dense.
Yeah.
So how does a rotating detonation engine actually work compared to a normal rocket? Can we explain the tech without the jargon?
I can try. The RDRE represents a radical departure from traditional propulsion physics. In a standard rocket engine, you rely on deflagration, which is continuous subsonic combustion. The fuel just burns smoothly.
Okay, like a steady burn.
Right. But Venus Aerospace is relying on detonation, which is a violent supersonic shockwave. They engineer a circular annular channel, essentially a hollow metal ring.
Got it.
They inject highly pressurized fuel, an oxidizer, into that ring and ignite it. The resulting supersonic shockwave of detonation continuously races around the inside of that circular channel, endlessly chase of its own tail and generating massive thrust out the exhaust.
Containing a continuous supersonic shockwave inside a metal ring sounds like a metallurgical nightmare. I mean, the heat and stress on those materials must be astronomical.
Oh, the engineering required to prevent the engine from literally tearing itself apart or melting is the primary hurdle here. But the thermodynamic math behind the RDRE is highly coveted.
Because it's more efficient.
Vastly more efficient. Because detonation extracts energy from the propellants much faster and more violently than traditional combustion, the engine achieves 20 to 30% better fuel efficiency.
That's a massive jump.
It is. Furthermore, because the physics of the detonation wave naturally pressurize the chamber, you can eliminate heavy, complex turbopumps from the engine design. The hardware becomes significantly lighter, resulting in a massively superior thrust-to-weight ratio.
So what does this all mean? Like, how does this impact the listener who isn't exactly in the market for an orbital launch vehicle?
Well, Venus Aerospace's primary objective isn't merely launching satellites into low Earth orbit. Their ultimate goal is applying this high-efficiency thrust architecture to commercial hypersonic atmospheric flight.
Wait, commercial passenger flights?
Yes. If they can successfully scale and stabilize the RDRE, they envision strapping this engine to a passenger space plane, exiting the dense lower atmosphere, and flying commuters from New York to Tokyo in approximately 2 hours.
2 hours? That's incredible. Transforming a 14-hour long-haul flight into a 2-hour commute fundamentally shrinks the physical globe.
It alters the mechanics of international commerce and travel entirely. But looking at the big picture of this $91 million funding round, it proves a vital point about the current tech landscape.
Which is?
That the aerospace industry is no longer an exclusive club for legacy defense contractors or massive giants like SpaceX. Small, hyper-agile startups with paradigm-shifting physics are successfully attracting the capital required to challenge the established giants.
But the report is very clear that securing funding and actually altering the physics of travel are two entirely different realities.
Oh, definitely. The gap between running a successful laboratory prototype for a few milliseconds and manufacturing a mass-produced, commercially viable hypersonic passenger engine is massive.
Yeah, the aerospace sector is a graveyard of startups that promised revolutionary thrust and delivered bankruptcy. But the sheer audacity of the ambition driving human advancement here is undeniable. I mean, they are literally attempting to harness endless contained explosions to rewrite the physical boundaries of the planet.
Which serves as a brilliant counterweight to the rest of the material we've covered today.
That's exactly. As we synthesize the overarching narrative of this deep dive, from Nintendo's retail strategy to Venus Aerospace's propulsion physics, the defining characteristic of this new technological era is the aggressive centralization of power.
It's happening everywhere.
Megacorporations are utilizing supply chain logistics to dictate that digital ownership is dead, forcing consumers to just rent access to their media. Enterprise hardware is shipping with catastrophic flaws that leave our networks exposed. And intelligence agencies are actively stepping in to mandate the cognitive boundaries of artificial intelligence.
Which brings the reality of this industry shift directly back to you, the listener. The technology industry is built on strict trade-offs. You are constantly negotiating the terms of your digital existence.
Right.
You trade the permanence of physical ownership for the instant gratification of cloud access. You trade the security of isolated systems for the convenience of interconnected, highly vulnerable infrastructure. You trade the chaotic innovation of open source software for the regulated safety of monitored ecosystems.
It's always a compromise.
Always. But it is crucial to remember that you are not a passive participant in this equation. The architecture of the future is negotiated every single day through your purchase decisions, your data hygiene, and your willingness to push back when corporate models cross the line from convenience into control.
I think that leaves us with a highly provocative, lingering question to consider as we close out this analysis.
Let's hear it.
If we step back and look at the trajectory we are currently on, if we are rapidly approaching a reality where we don't own our games, our networking hardware is vulnerable to silent takeovers, and AI is generating our digital world under government guardrails, do we actually own any part of our digital identity anymore? Or are we just renting our digital lives from a handful of megacorporations?
That is the defining question of the next decade.
Definitely something to analyze the next time you are prompted to blindly accept a massive terms of service agreement. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the shifting tectonic plates of the technology world. Keep examining the mechanisms behind the headlines, keep asking the hard questions, and we will see you on the next one.